Jan Wagner is a poet, essayist, and translator of British and American poetry, including the work of Charles Simic, Simon Armitage, and Matthew Sweeney. He's published 6 poetry collections since 2001, and the most recent, Regentonen Variationen, Rain Barrel Variations, won the Leipzig Book Fair Prize in 2015. His selected poems, 2001 to 2015, were published in 2016. Jan has won many awards for his poetry, and it has been translated into more than 30 languages. A selection in English, Self-Portrait with a Swarm of Bees, Selected Poems, translated by Ian Galbraith, was published in 2015 by ARC. Ian Galbraith is both a prize-winning translator and a poet in his own right. His first collection, The True Height of the Ear, is published by ARC this month, and we have pre-publication copies on sale. Ian has written widely on poetry and translation, and is the editor of 5 poetry anthologies. Unusually, he translates into both English and German, and has translated work by Alice Oswald and John Burnside, among others, into German. So, Jan Wagner and Ian Galbraith.
If you excuse me just for a second, I've got the wrong pair of glasses on.
Versuch über Mücken. Als hätten sich alle Buchstaben auf einmal aus der Zeitung gelöst und stünden als Schwarm in der Luft. Stehen als Schwarm in der Luft. Bringen von all den schlechten Nachrichten keine. Dürftige Musen, dürre Pegasusse summen sich selbst nur ins Ohr. Geschaffen aus dem letzten Faden von Rauch, wenn die Kerze erlischt. So leicht, dass sich kaum sagen lässt, sie sind, erscheinen sie fast als Schatten, die man aus einer anderen Welt in die unsere wirft. Sie tanzen, dünner als mit Bleistift gezeichnet, die Glieder, winzige Sphinxenleiber, der Stein von Rosetta, ohne den Stein.
An essay on midges. As if all the letters had suddenly floated free of a paper and formed a swarm in the air, they form a swarm in the air, of all that bad news telling us nothing. Those skimpy muses, wispy pegasuses, only a buzz with the hum of themselves, made from the last twist of smoke as the candle is snuffed. So light, you can hardly say they are. Looking more like shadows, umbrae jettisoned by another world to enter our own. They dance, their legs finer than anything pencil can draw, with their minuscule sphinx-like bodies. The Rosetta Stone without the stone.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for the invitation to Ledbury. It's a pleasure to be here and to listen and to walk around, and also a pleasure to be with you again. Ian, we have had several readings together. Here and there, and it's always lovely to do that. Yeah. With the surplus now that we are able to stumble through dark woods to go home to
a lovely host. Yeah. Last night.
With one small torchlight. In the woods, as in the translations, it's very easy to follow you and to depend on you leading the way. We'll do a mixture of reading and discussion talk in between. We have 4 small sets of poems which we'll read both in German and in English. And in between, we'll try to chat.
Yeah, we don't know what we're going to talk about, but it will be the terror of the earth, I'm sure.
So the next poem, I do love poems on small subject matters, the so-called banal things, which aren't, after all, banal, not in poetry. And so I enjoy writing about nails, filled mushrooms, fence posts, and whatever else. And this next poem is dedicated to one of those small and seemingly uninteresting objects. It's a poem on bed sheets, and I should add that it doesn't work if you think of elastic sheets. It works only with the classical white sheets that you were supposed to fold together with at least two persons, or with two persons to put them away. German title is Laken. Großvater wurde einbalsamiert in seines und hinausgetragen. Und ich entdeckte ihn ein Jahr später, als wir die Betten frisch bezogen, zur Wespe verschrumpelt, winziger Pharao eines längst vergangenen Sommers. So faltete man Laken, die Arme weit ausgebreitet, dass man sich zu spiegeln begann über die straff gespannte Fläche hinweg. Der Wäsche-Foxtrott dann, beschritt um Schritt, ein Rechteck im nächstkleineren verschwand, bis sie die Nasen fast berührten. Alles konnte verborgen sein in ihrem schneeigen Innern. Ein leerer Flakon mit einem Spukparfum, ein paar Lavendelblüten oder Wiesenblumen, ein Groschen oder ab und zu ein Wurf von Mottenkugeln in seinem Nest. Fürs Erste aber ruhten sie, stumm und weiß in ihren Schränken, ganze Stapel von ihnen, eingelegt in Duft, gemangelt, gebügelt, gestärkt und sorgfältig gepackt, wie Fallschirme vor einem Sprung aus ungeahnten Höhen.
Sheets. Grandfather was embalmed in his and carried out, and I discovered him 1 year later when we changed the beds, shriveled to a wasp, tiny pharaoh of a long-gone summer. Sheets were folded by spreading your arms to mirror your opposite across their taut expanse. Then came the laundry foxtrot, each rectangle swallowed by its half, our noses nearly touching. Anything could be hidden in their snowy hearts, an empty vial containing a ghost of perfume, lavender blossoms or meadow flowers, a penny, the odd clutch of mothballs in their nest. But now they slumbered, mute and white in their cupboards, great piles of them, steeped in fragrance, mangled, ironed and starched, as scrupulously stacked as parachutes before a jump from undreamt of heights.
Wippe. Mach dich schwerer, rufen sie. Also schließe ich beide Augen, denke an Säcke voll Zement und Eisengießereien, Elefanten, an den Anker in seinem Schlamm, wo ein Manöver Wale vorübergleitet, an das Bullenhaupt eines Ambosses. Nur eine Weile die Luft anhalten, warten. Doch nichts hebt sich oder senkt sich, während ein Fasan schreit und die Blätter fallen, meine unwilligen Beine zu kurz, um je den Grund zu fassen. Mein Kopf beinahe in den Wolken.
Cecil. Make yourself heavier, they call. I close both eyes, thinking of sacks of cement, iron foundries and elephants, an anchor sinking in deep mud while a fleet of whales maneuvers above it, an anvil's bullish head. For a while, I hold my breath and wait, to no avail. Nothing goes up, nothing goes down. A pheasant screams, leaves fall. My legs, too short, will never reach the ground. My head is well nigh in the clouds.
And the last poem before we start our conversation is a poem actually drawn from a longer sequence of 18 poems, all dedicated to the themes of love and food, a classical combination, of course. And it goes back to a quotation by Samuel Pepys from the diaries of Pepys, and where he describes being invited to Sir Penn's wedding anniversary, where one pie for every year of his marriage is being served, which is why the sequence is called 18 Pies, and every poem starts with a certain classical pie or pastry dish. So it starts, of course, with shepherd's pie, some fish pies, vegetable pies, and ends with three dessert pies, some pies based on fruit, pear and apple, and the last one, quince pâté, which is the one we're going to read. Quitten Pastete. Wenn sie der Oktober ins Astwerk hängte, ausgebeulte Lampions, war es Zeit. Wir pflückten Quitten, wuchteten körbeweise gelb in die Küche und das Wasser. Apfel und Birne reiften ihrem Namen zu, einer schlichten Süße, anders als die Quitte an ihrem Baum, im hintersten Winkel meines Alphabets, im Latein des Gartens, hart und fremd in ihrem Arom. Wir schnitten, viertelten, entkernten das Fleisch, vier große Hände, zwei kleine. Schemenhaft im Dampf des Entsafters gaben Zucker, Hitze, Mühe zu etwas, das sich roh dem Mund versagte. Wer konnte, wollte Quitten begreifen? Ihr Gelee in bauchigen Gläsern für die dunklen Tage in Regalen aufgereiht, in einem Keller von Tagen, wo sie leuchteten. Leuchten.
Quince Jelly. When October hung them among the leaves, those bulging lanterns, then it was time. We picked ripe quinces, lugged the baskets of yellow bounty into the kitchen, soused the fruits in water. The pears and apples grew towards their names, to a simple sweetness. Unlike quinces, clinging to branches in some shadowy borders alphabet, obscure in our garden's Latin, tough and foreign in their aroma. We cut, quartered, cored the flesh. We were four adult hands, two somewhat smaller, veiled by clouds of steam from the blender, poured in sugar, heat, and effort to something that, raw, made our palates bulk. But then, who could, who would hope to explain them? Quinces, jellied, lined up in bellied jars on shelves and set aside for the darkness, stored for harsher days, a cellar of days in which they shone, are still shining.
Shall I start by asking you some questions?
Well, you could.
Yeah, okay.
I've got one for you, actually, but you go on.
I think in poetry translation, it's our luxury that we can choose whatever we please to translate. Or in other words, it rarely happens that some publisher comes and says, would you please do a whole collection of this and this poet into German? In Germany, that never happens. So the luxury is that you can pick your favorite poets and your favorite poems, I think, and can do whatever you please, hoping perhaps that someday a publisher will do a book. But what is it that, if that is the case for you as well, what is it that draws you to a poem and makes you say, I will translate this poem into English or into German, because I should add that Ian is one of those rare creatures translating into both directions, German and English.
It's not quite true that you what you say, because I translate into German as well. I've got a few anecdotes from that side of the water. Certainly in my experience, it does sometimes happen that a publisher comes up to you and says, can you translate this? You know, where I remember, for instance, the first time I did a book by John Burnside, I was confronted in a men's toilet by a publisher who said, I've got you in my little black book. And it turned out that
it was Michael Kruger.
Yeah, it was Michael Kruger, yeah. And he wanted me to translate John Burnside's poems for a book. Anyway, what draws me to poets? I think it's extremely difficult because it happens so far down, so deep down in the personality. It's true that you, as a translator, you tend to choose people with whom you have some kind of affinity, but to describe the affinity is very difficult because it's a bit like asking somebody, why did you fall in love with that person? What made you fall in love? Mm. I mean, imagine trying to answer that question. Of course, there are a million answers usually to that question, but it's the same with poetry. It's very difficult. It's something that where you notice that there's something that you, almost as if you want to say what they're saying, or you're angry. I mean, I've had that reaction as well, where I've been angry for years. I was angry for years with John Burnside, just for an example. And something about the way that he was writing, I felt I should be writing that. It was a very violent beginning. I should be writing that, not you, kind of feeling. Envy. You know, these are unpleasant emotions. So it's not always, and I'm sure as well, when people fall in love, that it's not all pleasant. Mm. There are all kinds of things going on there that that are difficult to talk about at the best of times. And I think with translation, it is something like that. It's something very elemental, something that touches your personality very deeply.
And just like in love, it's not necessarily the person closest to your own nature,
yeah,
or the
right,
poet closest,
yeah,
to your own nature. What I enjoy most, I do enjoy translating poetry in general, but one of the great pleasures is that that you learn so much for your own writing. When you choose poets you like or dislike, or that you feel drawn to in some way, and translate them, you do read as closely as you would never read otherwise, and you learn a lot about how they write, how they work with imagery, how they work with meter, form, and so on, and maybe you learn even more if that poet is not writing in a fashion close to your own.
Mm.
For example, I was asked indeed to translate an American blues poet a couple of years ago, and which I had read before, but that's quite far from what I'm doing, of course. There's no blues poetry in Germany. And but doing that, I learned so much and got so many, or shown so many ways of writing and of expanding my knowledge of poetry, that was a great treasure.
And
well,
you were taken with that to places that you hadn't reckoned with.
That's
if
it.
I remember,
yes,
rightly. What was that? Did you end up having to do one of those poems to music, or?
Well, that particular poet, Kevin Young, came over to Berlin. So we had a reading in Berlin, and we were supposed to read both, of course, the American originals and the German translations, and he brought along two guitar players, and he's got a magnificent voice, and he's a great performer, and we had arranged, as we have, to read the original first, then the German translation, and so on, and he was accompanied by the two guitar players, and basically didn't read out his poetry, but he performed or sang with this lovely voice those poems of his, and unfortunately, the guitar players wouldn't stop after Kevin had finished his original version, so that I was forced to sing the blues in German, which, if you have heard that, it's impossible to do and quite ridiculous. So it has caused quite a trauma, but made me write some blues poems myself to get rid of the trauma, and that was worth the whole process. Shall we read some more?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Let's read the poem about a child falling into a well, which has never happened to me. Not to you either, I suppose.
No, but you would never know it from reading this poem.
Im Brunnen. 6-7 Meter freier Fall. Und ich war weiter weg als je zuvor. Ein Kosmonaut in seiner Kapsel aus Feldstein betrachtete aus der Ferne das kostbare, runde Blau. Ich war das Kind im Brunnen. Nur die Moose kletterten am geflochtenen Strick ihrer selbst nach oben, Efeu stieg über Efeu Schultern ins Freie, entkam. Ab und zu der weiße Blitz eines Vogels, ab und zu der weiße Vogel Blitz. Ich aß, was langsamer war. Der Mond, der sich über die Öffnung schob, ein Forscherauge über Mikroskop. Gerade als ich die Wörter Assel und Stein als Assel und Stein zu begreifen lernte, drang Lärm herab, ein Hasten, Schreie. Und vor mir begann ein Seil. Ich kehrte zurück ins Läuten der Glocken, zurück zu Brotgeruch und Busfahrplänen, dem Schatten unter Bäumen, Gesprächen übers Wetter, kehrte zurück zu Taufen und Tragödien, den Schlagzeilen, von denen ich eine war.
In the well. 6-7 meters free fall, and I was further away than ever before. A cosmonaut in his field stone capsule, gazing from afar at the precious round of blue. I was the child in the well. Only the moss climbed the braided twine of itself to the lip. Ivy climbed on shoulders of ivy into the open to freedom. Now and then, the white flash of a bird. Off and on, the white bird flash. I ate anything slower. The moon slid over the opening, a boffin's eye at the microscope. Just when the words slater and stone had begun to mean slater and stone, noise arrived, a hollering and hurrying. In front of my nose began a rope. I went back to tolling bells, back to bread smells and bus times, to shade under the trees and talking about the weather. Went back to christenings and tragedies, to the headlines, of which I was one.
Then the next poem is, like many of these poems, plays with traditional forms and tries to subvert them and or dance with them. So this Quince poem we've been reading was in fact a sapphic ode, which this afternoon, during this lovely discussion of the translation duel, the question arose whether you should stick to the form or not. Now, you do that most of the time. You stick to the form slavishly, and did so with the following poem as well, which is a rondeau. So it plays with two rhymes only and repeats one short phrase, which pops up in the beginning and is repeated in the middle and at the end. Maulbeeren. So dunkel und süß der Saft, dass überm Bach die Fledermäuse stiegen, immer flach am Blattwerk, um als flinke, schwarze Scheren die Früchte abzuknapsen, zu verzehren im Flug. Die Sonne hinter Jaffa schwach und alles, was man denken wollte, dachte, enger, kleiner als ein Handschuhfach. Sag Maulbeeren und wieder Maulbeeren, so dunkel und süß, allein das Wort im Mund. Schon sind sie wach und wollen mit dem schattenhaften Krach von Tausenden von Flügeln sich vermehren, hängen bei Tag in ihrem Schlaf in schweren und dicken Trauben unter deinem Dach, so dunkel und süß.
Mulberries, so dusky and sweet was their juice that over the stream the bats arced skyward, curvature flush with the leaves, their deft black scissors ready to nip the ripest fruits and lift them away, gorged on the wing. Pale sun beyond Jaffa, and all of thinking, present, past, future, as cramped as a glove compartment, tighter. Just say mulberry. Again, mulberry. So dusky and sweet, the very word in one's mouth. Roused, eager, now they are bent on swelling their number with their racket of a thousand-wing shindy, during the daylight hours suspended, heavy in sleep, their clusters under your rafters, so dusky and sweet.
Requiem für einen Friseur. Weil montags alles ruht, nun alles Montag bleibt, verhängt die Spiegel, nimmt der Schere ihren Schneid. Wer ließe Finger kneten, kreisen, bis die Wolke des Shampoos aufzieht über uns? Wer dirigierte sein Gefolge von Fläschchen und den Duft, die Öle im Regal mit einer schmalen Hand? Wer wirft die große Orgel aus Föhnen an und lässt sie brausen, lässt sie schwellen, nehmt von den Farben schwarz, vermischt es mit den hellen? Weil jetzt kein Umhang mehr so prachtvoll, langsam wie ein Zelt herabsinkt überm Körper, und wer innehält, nicht länger weiß, was es zu finden gilt, wonach zu suchen, nur dass die Haare weiter wachsen, weiter wuchern.
Requiem for a hairdresser. He always rested on Mondays. Now Monday's here to stay. So cover the mirrors, make blunt the scissors' blade. Who'd let another's fingers lather and rinse and knead while clouds of shampoo gathered? Who could command his suite of bottles and perfumes, massage in essential oils with such a slender hand? Who'll tow the pedals, allow the blow-dryer's organ to roar? Who'll open the flues, take back from the palate, mix it with lighter hues? For from today, no gorgeous gown will gently sink to cover our clothes, and whosoever stops to think will search in vain, bereft, and never know for what, except that hair keeps growing, left will never stop.
And the last poem before we start talking again is in fact the title poem of this book, a sort of self-portrait, with the German title Selbstporträt mit Bienenschwarm. Bis eben nichts als eine feine Linie um Kinn und Lippen. Jetzt ein ganzer Bart, der wächst und wimmelt, bis ich Magdalena zugleichen scheine, ganz und gar behaart von Bienen bin. Wie es von allen Seiten heranstürmt, wie man langsam Gramm um Gramm an Dasein zunimmt, an Gewicht und Weite, das regungslose Zentrum vom Gesang. Ich ähnele mit meinen ausgestreckten Armen einem Ritter, dem die Knappen in seine Rüstung helfen, Stück um Stück, erst Helm, dann Harnisch, Arme, Beine, Nacken, bis sie sich kaum noch rühren kann, nicht läuft, nur schimmernd dasteht, nur mit ein paar Winden hinter dem Glanz, ein bisschen alter Luft und wirklich sichtbar erst mit dem Verschwinden.
self-portrait with a swarm of bees. A moment ago, I wore at best a fuzz around my chin and lips, but now my beard is growing and seething. I might even pass for Magdalena, all my face hirsute with bees. How they come buzzing from every side, and ounce by ounce, how a person's being slowly but steadily gains in weight and spread to become the stone's still center of song. My arms outstretched, I bear a resemblance to some ancient knight whom bustling varlets help to fit his suit of armor piece by piece, first the helmet, then the harness, arms, legs, nape, until he can hardly move, who does not tread, just stands there gleaming, with barely a hint of wind behind the luster, lingering breath, and only vanishing, becomes distinct. Jan, I've got to ask you a question about German poetry in a way, but it's mostly about yourself. Let's just say that people in the audience know nothing at all about German poetry. And they come to a reading, and here's Jan Wagner at a reading, and they say, ah, so that's German poetry. How would you disabuse them, or would you? Are your poems very typical, would you say, of what's going on in German poetry at the moment? Or what has been, maybe more to the point, what was going on when you started writing?
Well, when I started writing, it was the 80s, and not a particularly exciting time for poetry in Germany, I think, although all the classic writers were still writing. So you had Hans Magnus Enzensberger, and Günter Kunert, Christoph Wolff, and all these writers, Sarah Kirsch, and all these writers were still writing. But what we witness nowadays, or since maybe 15 or 17, 18 years, is that a very enthusiastic younger generation is writing, and it would be hard to pin down, you know, what they are writing like. I think the most striking feature is that there are so many voices and so many styles of writing at the moment. And I think it's true in every country that you have a sort of a gap or a gulf between the so-called language poetry and the so-called traditional poetry, or between tradition and progression. And that's probably true more or less for every literature. And I think the fact that the younger generation is writing in such a lively manner, and there's so many different ways of writing are possible, meaning language poetry as well as traditional poetry, and furthermore the mix of both, is due to the fact that this gulf has, in the late 80s and early 90s, become smaller and smaller, so that nowadays you don't have to subscribe to some school anymore. You don't have to subscribe to some poetic ideal. You can just pick whatever appears to be good poetry and interesting in a way, be it from the language poetry side or from the traditional side, be it political poetry or nature poetry, and you can put it together in whatever way you want. And that, I think, has been a great enrichment for the younger generation, and is one of the reasons why poetry or the poetry scene is so lively at the moment, or has been for the past 10, 15 years.
One of the things that... were you just going to...
It would be hard to say what that is. What is German poetry like?
Yes.
Would have been as difficult 50, 60 years ago.
I'll come back to that, perhaps, with a third question. But one thing that strikes me as being very exciting about the contemporary scene in Germany, and I know that you will confirm this because you said it to me yourself, that nearly every German poet in the younger generation is also a translator.
Many are, and that's a good point, because the wealth we are witnessing is also due to the fact that it's not only the German tradition, of the German language tradition of poetry, but that you have poets like Henry Jackson or Anya Utler, who are lovely, and who are heavily influenced by the Russian tradition. You have poets drawn to Polish poetry, who in fact were born in Poland and are writing in German, like Dagmara Kraus and Andrei Rudolph. And of course, the English language tradition has been very important as well. So the influence of American or modern American poetry has been there and is still visible, and also of English poetry or Irish poetry. And in my own case, of course, it's true to say that being a translator of English language poetry, I have been very much influenced by Irish poetry or modern American poetry as well as British poetry.
Mm. That's very... I think it's been a very important thing for you, hasn't it? British poetry, more so than perhaps for any other German poet.
Possibly.
I think so. Yeah. But you also find roots in German poetry as well.
Of course.
I mean, it's a very rich tradition, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's what you start with. You start with what you read and what you can or seem to be able to understand immediately. So I started out because I fell in love with the so-called early expressionist poems, the poets like Georg Trakl and Georg Heim. Trakl, who's been translated by Michael Hamburger, I believe.
Several people.
Several people. Yeah. And Heim has been translated as well.
I forgot by whom. Yeah.
But them I loved. Bertolt Brecht, I read a lot. But then quite quickly also English language poetry came into play. But there are several poets in Germany whom I could name as poets I adored when I started and whom I still adore. Peter Huchel is one of these poets, for example. Yeah. Yeah. And some poets of your own tradition you return to again and again. And have to, because they are still overwhelming presences and continue to be that, like Gottfried Benn and the aforementioned Brecht. And not to mention the classics like Hölderlin and Goethe, of course. You have to read them and reread them again and learn from them, of course, and find out what they did.
I think that when I first went to Germany, not when I first went to Germany, but the period when I started to become interested in German poetry and involved in its publishing and so on, right in the beginning of the 80s. And I was working in a magazine at the time, and we had editorial meetings and discussion of the work being sent in. It had a particular kind of tone that I think has completely disappeared now. And it disappeared more or less at the time when the kind of poetry scene that you are describing as the young, new poets of the 80s, 90s, and onwards came into being. And it was a post-war phase, actually, that probably lasted as long as 1980. Our discussions were very, very much under the cloud of what had happened, the catastrophe of the war and of the concentration camps and the use of language in the Third Reich and the terrible stories that were actually still at that time appearing with a freshness and with consequences that later on seem no longer to have played as strong a role as they did then. Our interrogation of poetry was all informed by, you've mentioned Gottfried Benn, but Brecht, and of course Paul Celan is another writer that one has to mention in that context. But I feel that this phase has passed, that the new poetry that you are describing doesn't seem to take its bearings from the catastrophe of the Shoah and of the killing fields of the Second World War. Would you say that's true? Or would you say that what I'm saying you don't recognize? It's another possibility that...
Oh, no, I do recognize it, of course. It's true. Mm. I think it's still there in that we are, of course, reading all, you know, all those generations who did precisely what you described. The Karlschlag literature and so on, and the very careful readjustment and working with that tainted language. Mm. So by reading them and studying them closely, I think that's part of the process of becoming a young poet, that you read these people and the awareness of what happens with language and to language, I think, is also there with the young poets writing today. Has to be. Mm-hmm. Shall we read one more poem?
Let's
we'll read.
How are we going for time? We're going quite
fine. Yeah. We have 1 hour, don't we?
Yes, we do. Yeah.
We'll read an animal poem dedicated to an animal I've never seen, but I would love to see. But you rarely get the chance to see it. It's in German, it's called Grottenolm, and it's a tiny reptile, which is to be found in the, I think there are two populations in Europe, one in the Harz Mountains in Germany, and one in the border region of Slovenia and Italy, in the karst, the rocky
crevasses of the...
Yes, and it's living deep down and...
in caves.
It's a very shy, very shy and very interesting animal.
Almost sort of mythical in a way, isn't it? Because nobody ever sees one, or rarely.
Read it in turns, right?
Yeah. Pardon?
It's a three-part poem, and we read it in turns. Yeah. So, Grottenolm. Eins. Kaum wirklicher als das Einhorn und selten wie Sphinx oder Drache, für dessen Brut man ihn hielt, als er sich erstmals zeigte, Medusenhaupt im Spiegel eines Baches. Schneeweißer Fisch mit vier Beinen, wie die Bauern ihn nannten, dem Schrei eines Menschen. Seine Kunst, vergessen zu werden. So wird er alt. So überlebt er, die nach ihm suchen.
Olm. Hardly more real than the unicorn, and as rare as Sphinx or dragon, whose offspring it was thought to be when first it came to light, a Medusa's head in the mirror of a stream. A snow-white fish with four legs, the country folk called it, its cry like that of a human, its skill to be forgotten. And so it grows old and outlives those who seek it.
Zwei. In einem Reich ohne Licht und ohne Farben, ohne Wind, sitzt der Olm, der keine Feinde außer der Sonne hat, zarter als die Arbeit von Glasbläsern ist, kaum schwerer als ein Brief und leichter als ein Schluck Wasser. Weiß er nichts von unserer Welt oder weiß er alles? Mit einer Haut so durchlässig, dass sie nichts verwehrt und alles aufnähme an Giften, an Reichtümern, beschränkt er sich aufs Wenige, verzichtet aufs Essen, sogar auf den eigenen Schatten.
In a realm without light, without color, without wind, you'll find the Olm, who has no enemies but the sun, is frailer than the work of a glass blower, little heavier than a letter, and lighter than a mouthful of water. Does it know nothing of our world, or does it know all? With a skin so transparent that it blocks nothing and would let all poisons through, all treasures, it restricts itself to a minimum, does without food, even without its own shadow.
Drei. Ich muss dir nahe gekommen sein, damals, hinter der Grenze, von der du nichts ahnst, in Karst, jener Gegend, in der noch immer verschwinden kann, wer spät in der Nacht zum Rauchen hinausgeht, auf löchrigem Grund, hoch überm System von Grotten, wo Rost auf Waffen lagert, vielleicht gar Soldaten ergraut auf ein Ende des Krieges warten, Jahrzehnte nach Ende des Krieges, wo du, geschmeidiges Ess, durch Leeren fliegst, die dir sicher sind, in päpstlichem Weiß durch Höhlen, Himmel, kälterer Bruder, durch episches Dunkel mit nichts als der Uhr aus tropfendem Wasser und blind wie Homer.
3. I must have been close to you then, across a border of which you knew nothing, in the caste, a region where even today, one who goes out for a smoke on the fissured ground at night, high above the system of caves, can easily go missing, a place where rust settles on weapons and soldiers may wait for the end of a war that has ended decades before, and where you, lithesome S, can fly through hollow spaces in safety in papal white, through caves and heavens, colder brother, through epic darkness with nothing but the clock of dripping water and blind as Homer.
We would read three more poems, both in German and English, but if you have a question or some remark, please go ahead and...
This would be a good time if anybody had any questions.
Yeah, sure, Sasha. Pardon me? What is it? You want to describe the animal further?
Well, it's white because it has no light. Like all cave animals, it's a kind of reptile, very, very rare. The poem describes it actually quite well. like a salamander, but completely white, and called an olm, that is the word for it.
Or the axolotl, possibly.
Is it an axolotl?
Well, it's not, but looking, colours, slightly similar, possibly. But rarely to be seen, really. I know one person who has ever seen a Grottenolm.
Well, Jan's poetry celebrates the things of the world. You know, the animals, the little, it could be anything, a glass of water, a pair of spectacles, a microphone, a flower. How does it come about that, I mean, do you suddenly get taken by the strangeness of an object? Or is it because it is so familiar to you that because an object becomes so familiar? Obviously, the olm can't have become very familiar. But if it was a small thing like, and indeed, quite a few of the animals that you describe in the poems are quite exotic, really, a koala bear or chameleon. A lot of things, on the other hand, not. What would you say?
Well, in some cases, it's precisely that exotic appeal. I mean, in the case of the Grottenolm or other plants or animals. But really, the wonderful thing is that the most banal object can reveal a great richness in poetry. And it has been my experience that starting off with such a neglected thing, and to focus all your thought on such a thing, I fare better than in starting with a grand idea. I think it's a lot better not to sit down and plan to write a poem on love or friendship or war or death, because then you are, I think, too endangered to stick to those abstract concepts. Whereas if you start out with a glass of water, you might, and that poem, of course, exists already. Josef Brodsky has written it. Mm-hmm. You start out finishing with a poem about death of the circles of life and love. And
I think it was Lenin, wasn't it, who talked about the glass of water first, talking about love.
Who?
Lenin, I think it was.
Right.
And that might have been where Brodsky got. I don't know. I mean,
I always imagine Sasha Brodsky sitting in some cafe in Venice and having an espresso and getting a glass of water with it, and then thinking, "Of course, that's precisely what should be written about." And that's what happens, isn't it? You see something and you think, "This word or this thing has deserved a poem," and I might actually discover something new when focusing on this small object And on the language with which we describe that object, or try to describe it.
And the world in which the object is situated, active, or whatever. Yeah.
As you are so precise in your poems, have you ever really disagreed with the translation?
I'll go outside the room.
Well, I mean, there are, as I mean, everybody knows that if you translate a poem, you interpret the poem, and you have to. There are so many possibilities of translating a poem as there are translators, and so many good possibilities as well. So, but I think if you can trust a translator completely, you have to grant him or her the freedom to do whatever he or she thinks necessary to render it into a good poem in the target language. And you can disagree with the translation. I mean, if you write in a haiku and the translation suddenly has seven lines, you might get skeptical. Or if you write a sonnet and you think the form does matter in this particular case, it would be a disappointment to find a translation using only seven lines. That is clear. But there are mistakes. Mistakes occur. But personally, I think it's a good, a wise decision to get into a conversation, to enter a conversation and talk about the poem, which is what I like to do when I translate some English language poet into German. I try to get the permission to ask silly questions, because in my experience there are no silly questions, and all questions that are being posed may lead to a better translation. But misunderstandings are bound to happen, and there can be grave mistakes where. You can only be glad if you get the opportunity to say something and say, well, that's not quite what I meant. Or that word actually means something else in Hamburg than in Berlin. Mm. Like that.
Yeah. I was really interested by this idea of post-war poetry working through a tainted language, as you consider. And you talked about more recent schools of poetry. Has that affected the way that
has what? The way that it was written, poetry was written after the...
You talked about this idea when everyone was sort of working against useless phrases.
I was talking.
Yes,
Do you feel like as a contemporary poet, like writing in German, your relationship to language is necessarily different because of that?
Yes, I do think so. Yeah, I mean, everybody writing poetry is quite aware of the innuendos and the etymology. But having read those poets who were forced to think about German anew, you do get an awareness, of course, of the whole, and not only the poets, but recently we've been it's become more urgent again to think about how language can be poisoned, how language is poisoned by certain usages, and how language can be infiltrated by hate and by sentiments you shouldn't agree with, and so it's not only poetry that offers a possibility to learn about those ways, but for example, that wonderful book LTU by Viktor Klemperer, where he talks. Klemperer was a professor in Dresden who survived being Jewish the Nazi era.
Professor of romance, but
he was a very very aware witness of what was happening and wrote a book on the way language was misused and infiltrated by spiteful ideology, and that's my feeling is that that's a book that's very very much should be be read again because he very precisely describes what happens if you slowly drop by drop poison language with certain words. And that's precisely what's happening again. There was a discussion 2 years ago in Germany about the word "völkisch," and that word was introduced again. And people said, "Well, you should be allowed to say that, shouldn't you?" mm-hmm. and so on. And that's and to read Klemperer again and read about that, that's quite fascinating to discover that this process is far from being old.
Yeah.
Now we don't have time to read poems. Well, maybe one.
One. Yeah?
Shall we read the one untranslatable poem? Because you asked about misunderstandings and it's actually a poem which I thought could not be translated because it's dedicated to a weed, a German weed called Giersch, which I, having only a balcony in Berlin, don't have to do with so much, but that weed is something that every gardener in Germany hates because you can eat it, but you can't eat so much of it that you can clear the whole garden. It comes back again and again. And the beautiful thing for me is that that name, Giersch, contains the word gier, meaning greed, which is precisely what's the one quality of that weed. And also the sounds of it are an invitation to let language grow and to let language overgrow the poem, which is what I tried to do in the German version. So there are certain difficulties, which Ian can describe better than I do, in translating that poem. Gier. Nicht zu unterschätzen, der Gier, mit dem Begehren schon im Namen. Darum die Blüten, die so schwebend weiß sind, keusch wie ein Tyrannentraum. Kehrt stets zurück wie eine alte Schuld, schickt seine Kassiber durchs Dunkel, unterm Rasen, unterm Feld, bis irgendwo erneut ein weißes Widerstandsnest emporschießt. Hinter der Garage beim knirschenden Kies der Kirsche Giersch, als Schäumen, als Gischt, der ohne ein Geräusch geschieht, bis hoch zum Giebel kriecht, bis Giersch schier überall sprießt, im ganzen Garten Giersch über Giersch schiebt, ihn verschlingt mit nichts als Giersch.
The plant that's being referred to here is ground elder, right? So you probably, from the description, recognized it. The only trouble with ground elder for me was that it doesn't deliver the vocals or the vowels that you need in order to create this atmosphere of strangulation and suffocation, as in the German poem. And so I went for the vowels first and got an I, an E sounds, sharp and oppressive, in the form of the bindweed, which isn't, of course, the same thing, but it is also an unpleasant thing for gardeners very often, and it does proliferate. Do not underestimate the bindweed, its need for wreath and stifle rooted deep in its name. Hence the blossom, blinding white, as chaste as a tyrant's dream. Like an ancient crime, an unpaid debt, it returns to haunt a scene. By cover of darkness, beneath the fields or a lawn, it sends out feelers, fires a riot, rises glorious and green. Behind the barn, convolved in cypress or bean, the unkind climber spirals, a seething, creeping spume. It twines up walls and roan, choking windows and drain, trumpeting, binding, abiding, till nothing breathes but bindweed, and nothing more is seen.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.